This episode contains discussions of sensitive topics. Listener discretion is advised. IATSE891 presents Apple Box Talks, the podcast where we get to talk to the very best artists, technicians, and stakeholders that make up the BC entertainment industry. From prep to post and everything in between, we create worlds on screens of all sizes. Welcome to Apple Box Talks. I'm Crystal.
And I'm Hillary. Today we're joined by local activist and school board trustee, Michael Sasakamos. Michael currently works as the first ever Director of Indigenous Relations and Reconciliation for the City of Burnaby. Michael has used her lived experience and voice to work collectively with others to dismantle systemic racism and silos and to indigenize colonial spaces. She's joining us today on the Apple Box to talk about her work and the City of Burnaby's plans to celebrate National Indigenous Peoples Day on June 21st. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here today.
Welcome. Thank you for the time. So let's just dive right in. Are you willing to share with us a little bit about your family and the nation that you're a part of?
Yes. So again, my name is Michael Sasakamos. I am a member of the Atakakoot Cree Nation, but I'm also Tkamloops, Tishkwamek, and Sealk. And I was born and raised on my reserve in Kamloops, where I lived my whole life before I moved here with my family to live on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Kwikwetlem peoples. I guess a few things about my family, and I guess maybe a little bit more about myself as well, is that, as you mentioned, I'm a school board trustee, so I'm the first Indigenous person to be elected to a colonial government, what is now known as Burnaby, in more than 130 years. And I say it that way because, as I mentioned, the host nations have been governing and stewarding these lands since time immemorial, and they have their own governance systems. And so it's important to make a distinction that I was elected to a colonial government as an Indigenous person. But traditional Indigenous ways of knowing and being in governance have existed on these lands, time out of mind. My family has been very involved in advancing rights and title for First Nations people across the country, in both BC and Saskatchewan in particular, but also at the national level. And growing up on my reserve, I grew up next door to my great-grandparents and my grandparents. And I got to spend a lot of time with them and watch them and see the things that they were doing and how they interacted with people and worked towards making our rights known and establishing those rights and making sure that First Nations people in particular were able to participate in systems that were created to oppress us. And my great-grandfather was one of the founders of the Indian Brotherhood, which is now the Assembly of First Nations. My great-grandmother, my grandmother, even my mother, spent a lot of time establishing the BC Native Women's Society and helping get First Nations women the right to vote, for example, and just doing a lot that I was able to watch them and see them do these things as me and my cousins ran around playing, hearing these kinds of conversations at their table and seeing all the different people that were coming into their house and all the amazing people in Indian country, as we would say, who were doing this great work. And so I was able to see those people do their work and experience that and hear it and have those really amazing role models. And that's what really taught me that there are many different ways to make change. There are many different ways to do this important work to advance Indigenous rights and title. But the way that I connect most with is a way that I learned from them, and that's trying to make change from within. And so I also worked for 15 years as a federal public servant in Indigenous relations, working on behalf of the Crown. And that was a very challenging experience, I think, as well as a First Nations person. But how I justified that to myself and why I expended the emotional labor to do that kind of work for so long was because I really believe that that is one of the ways to make changes from within.
That is a rich tapestry of role models you've grown up with who have impacted you. And I'm going to ask a very basic question.
What is the biggest difference between colonial government and indigenous governance?
I don't think that is a very basic question, because as indigenous peoples, we're all different and we all have different systems of governance and ways of knowing. We all have different cultures and languages. In British Columbia alone, there are more than 200 bands of First Nations people. And so we're a very diverse people. But ultimately, there are some basic tenets, I think, that we all kind of ascribe to as part of our governance systems. And those are things like collaboration. Those are things like authenticity. Those are things like respect. And those are things like culture and language and our connections to our lands.
I'm really struck by how gracious you've been even with us in the process of preparing for this interview and the emotional labor that it takes, making change from within and the bravery that requires. How do you do it? How do you keep going?
I don't know. I mean, it's exhausting, right? It's exhausting, but I do know that I'm not doing it alone. I do it with a lot of other people, and a lot of other people are doing the work too. So it's not just me. And I think that's really important to recognize. And it's not even just people who are doing this work with regards to Indigenous relations. You know, as you mentioned in my introduction, that I also work towards, you know, not just dismantling systemic racism, but also silos. And I think that marginalized people and oppressed people, particularly people who have experienced colonization around the world, have a lot in common. And we're all kind of working towards the same goals. And so the more that we're able to identify with each other and build relationships with each other and work together collaboratively towards our common goals based on our shared experiences and knowledge, I think is what really helps motivate me and remind me when I'm feeling really tired or overwhelmed that I'm not alone and that their work helps me and my community and my work helps them and their community. Because ultimately, if you can help educate people and build empathy for one group of people or one community, that can extend to other people as well. And so it's really trying to build those relationships and remember those things and be mindful that our suffering is not in isolation. But yeah, it is really tiring for sure. And I think especially when you work in colonial spaces, people either see you as an employee doing a job and they don't recognize that your job is actually quite personal, that as an Indigenous person that you're carrying a lot of responsibility for your community. You're not just an individual in there punching a time clock. And so there's a lot of extra baggage in addition to that emotional labor that comes with working on behalf of your people, essentially, right? And I think that goes for everyone who is doing that kind of work. And that is really challenging. And, you know, trying to remind people of that and hoping that people will keep that in mind when they're interacting with you and to be gentle with you, but also for you to remember to be gentle with yourself, that, you know, you can't change everything, you can't do everything. And when you're working in these spaces, remembering that it does take a really long time and to really celebrate the small wins, because the big wins are few and far between still.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you're currently working at the City of Burnaby as the Director of Indigenous Relations and Reconciliation. This is a pretty new role for the City of Burnaby. So why did you decide to take on such a massive undertaking?
It is an entirely new role. It didn't exist before. And the City of Burnaby has been doing reconciliation for over a decade, but it's been informal and it's been off the sides of interested or motivated or dedicated individuals' desks. And so I actually was a parks commissioner as well before. I know Hillary is now too. She replaced me actually when I left the parks commission. And so it was really important for me as a community member who lives here in Burnaby to engage again in my community to try to make that change from within, which is why I wanted to be a parks commissioner in the first place, to really provide that Indigenous lens in my community to cultural opportunities in particular that were happening here. And through that work, I started to get to know people at the city. I started to get to know people in leadership. I started to understand more how the city operated, the work that they were doing, and the potential impacts to Indigenous rights and title, as well as interests of just other Indigenous people who live here but aren't members of host nations. And I started to talk to people about those things. And, you know, people would say to me, oh, well, we had an Indigenous manager before the pandemic, but they didn't last very long. And nobody's really done that job since. And the more I learned about it, the more I was able to identify some significant, for me, systemic issues around why that individual was unable to be successful in their position. And those issues were entirely systemic. The position was within a department that wasn't relevant. It didn't have a budget. It didn't have any staff or resources or capacity, any authority, any real mandate. And so it was almost set up for failure. And unbeknownst to the people that created the position, I mean, I give them credit. They were trying to do what they thought was right. But again, it's just an example of why this work needs to be informed, why all work to support marginalized peoples needs to be informed by the people the work is to respond to, right? And so I started to identify some of these gaps, like, hey, this isn't going to work if the people can't do anything. This isn't going to work if the people don't have resources, if they don't have authority, if they're not a standalone, if you're not recognizing the unique importance of this work and supporting it. And so it was really awesome because the people at the city of Burnaby have been, and the leadership have been so responsive to my suggestions and my recommendations and to these conversations and being so open to also hearing from other Indigenous voices and wanting to build those relationships with host nations that they had already been working on, like I said, for many years before I came. And so over time and through these discussions, we were able to work together to create a new division of Indigenous Relations and Reconciliation that reported directly to the CAO. So it was not within any other department. It has a director who's myself, an actual Indigenous person, because you'll also find oftentimes, especially in positions of senior leadership or decision makers working Indigenous relations, very few of them are actually Indigenous, and even fewer are authentic Indigenous peoples. And so it was really great that we were able to do that. The city really put its money where its mouth is by supporting this work, by giving it a budget, by creating positions for staff, so creating jobs as well. And so it's been really great. And when I bring initiatives to them, and not just to leadership, but the staff and department heads as well, they've all been so supportive of my work and worked really closely with me to really weave and incorporate work to advance reconciliation at the city of Burnaby and all of their departments and all of their work and encouraging all of their staff to participate in these processes. So over time, as I observed these things and I really came to believe that the city of Burnaby was serious about doing reconciliation, I agreed to come and work here because I had a good job before. I didn't need a job. I didn't need to come here. And I made that really clear that I would only come if it was the right work, if it had the right support, and if it was real and honest, because I wasn't going to be anybody's token. And that was really important to me. And I don't feel that way at the city, and I never have. And I really appreciate that because in a sense, it's a really cool opportunity for somebody like me too, because essentially it's a blank slate. And that is something that I communicate as well to the host nations, is that like, hey guys, we can kind of do whatever here. Like there's no precedent. There's nobody, like all my years of experience in the federal government, it was always like, oh, you can't do that. Oh, we don't do that. No, we can't. We don't do this. No, that's against policy. Like all these things by the city, they're like, oh, what an interesting idea. Like let's explore that. Even if it doesn't always happen, there's always a willingness to explore different ideas and try new things. And so for me, that's really exciting in Indigenous relations, working in government.
Was there a specific moment that you knew they were serious about reconciliation? Like, what was that light bulb?
they just kept saying yes when I said, well, you have to do this. And I was saying that they had to do things that other people have said no to over and over and over again. Because Indigenous relations is really cool right now. It's really hip. It's really trendy. Like, everybody's trying to do reconciliation. And I just did air quotes for those of you who can't see me. And so it's very performative for a lot of people and organizations and governments as well. And so I get like calls from recruiters like every month, basically, because everyone's trying to recruit for these kinds of positions. And not a lot of people have the same kind of experience that are able to do them again authentically. And so the options are unlimited. And so, what, like I said, I had a good job. I didn't need a job. So I was in a really privileged position to be able to ask for the moon and not care if I didn't get it because I didn't need that job, which I acknowledge is a super privileged position. But it was also really interesting because most people would say, oh, no, we can't do that. Oh, no, this is the salary limit. Oh, no, there's not going to be any staff. Oh, no, you're not going to be a director. Oh, no, it has to be within this. Like, it was always no, a lot of no's. But everything I asked the city of Burnaby was like, yeah, we can do that. Yeah, we can do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's look into that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can check into that too, you know? And it was never, oh no, absolutely not. And so it's, and again, it's not like they gave me every single thing, but like they were very open to have discussions about doing something new and unique and progressive. And when I finally realized that I didn't have any more things to ask them for, and they had basically supported all of my recommendations and all my suggestions, it almost got to the point, we joke about it today, where I couldn't say no any longer.
So in the time that you've been the director, the city's hosted some really wonderful events. I was super excited and privileged to bring along my son to the Hope and Health Community Camp. Can you talk about that initiative and how that kind of came to be, and why events like that are so important in the city?
Yeah, well, like I said, the city was doing work again before I came. I want to really acknowledge and honor the good work that staff at the city were doing before I came, just on their own, because they cared as individual people about reconciliation and about Indigenous relations and building positive relationships with Indigenous peoples and, you know, educating people as best they could through the resources and opportunities and forums that they had to do that. And so it's important for me to really acknowledge and recognize that. So this National Indigenous Peoples Day celebration in particular is one of those events that the city has been doing for a long time. Since before I came to work here, I mean, I've worked at the city full time for about a year and a half, but I've been working as a consultant for the city for almost 4 years now. And so I've been able to work with staff, particularly from Parks, Recreation, and Culture, who were leading work to plan the National Indigenous Peoples Day celebration. We collaborate, we co-chair, we work side by side to put the event on now, and which is really important because we all bring our areas of expertise and our knowledge and work really closely together to put on a great event. I don't think anyone, again, should be doing it or operating in silos. It's important because we all bring something really special and important that ensures the success of that event. The Hope and Health Community Camp is also a partnership, and it is so, so very close to my heart. It is an event that I initiated, though, at the city. Hope and Health is an organization, a nonprofit, that really supports the concept of reconciliation. And it supports reconciliation or reconciliation by working together really closely with youth. Primarily, they work with First Nations youth in First Nations communities throughout BC to create opportunities for youth to engage in sport, to engage with mentors, to create resources in community for youth to do this, providing equipment for them to do this and other funds and other supports to be able to really build that capacity in Indigenous communities to support youth to be healthy and to learn about their community and their history and their culture by building relationships and helping support them to be healthier and happier people. And they do some really amazing, awesome work. And I've always really admired what they do in community. They also host a large community camp in Vancouver at BC Place. And I heard about it 1 year and I went, took my kids, and I saw what they were doing and I was just blown away. The camp was for any children and youth, so not just Indigenous. They had representatives from the host nations there speaking about their communities and their culture, their history, their experiences as Indigenous people, experiencing discrimination and oppression as trying to participate in sport when they were growing up. But also, again, Hope and Health has a lot of really great partnerships with UBC Thunderbirds, for example, the Whitecaps, EA Sports as well, who helped them do this work. And so they've all come together to put on this event where youth are running around and they're experiencing, yes, a little bit of soccer, but they're also having some fun. There's some cultural opportunities for them. There's some very age-appropriate and accessible exercises for them to contemplate reconciliation and residential schools and the history of colonization in this country. And they have that exposure as well to Indigenous peoples. And I just thought, wow, this is brilliant. This is so beautiful. And it really, even today when I talk about it, it kind of makes me emotional because it was just so amazing, really, the work that they were doing. And you could just see the changes. The kids would do this craft. It's called a reconciliation star. And it was like, what does reconciliation mean to me? And they could kind of color it and write down their reflections. And then at the end of the day, anybody who wanted could have an opportunity to say their reflection out loud. And it was just so beautiful to really hear what kids had learned and kids who had not ever had these kind of conversations or contemplated these kind of really complex or kind of very foreign concepts in their lives, right? And so it was just really beautiful to see how easy it was for them to educate and create those connections. And I just thought, I need to be a part of this. And I started to get to know the people that were leading that work at Hope and Health and to build relationships with them. And I said, let's do this in Burnaby. And like I said, I was really supported at the City of Burnaby to do this work. We put the camp on. It's fully funded by the city. Our first year, I think that was when you were there, Hillary, we had 200 participants, which was the limit. We had at least 50 people on the wait list. We actually had more registrations than that because many adults also registered, who we had to tell the adults that they couldn't come because it was only for children and youth. But people were just looking for something like this, and people were just wanting that opportunity. And so when I look at it and I think about why are we doing this, and now it's an annual event and we're up to 250, which also filled up last year with a wait list. And we give the kids a orange jersey with a custom design from an artist from a host nation. They get a little medal and a ball. We share a meal together. Again, we have all our partners. Because we're in Burnaby, we also partner with the SFU women's soccer team now, as well as the UBC Thunderbirds. The Whitecaps will come. EA Sports, obviously, home here in Burnaby, they come. Harvest Meat supports us. We have a lot of really great relationships and partnerships of people that help us do this work. But where I really see what it is it's engaging the youngest people in our community in reconciliation. And I think that's really something special. And I love that Burnaby has taken that responsibility on and is really owning that. And it's such a beautiful and positive experience here, just like I first saw it when it happened in Vancouver. And people are already asking about next year. And I can't wait. We're already planning. So I really look forward to that.
So you made history in October 2022 as the first Indigenous person to be elected in Burnaby to a colonial government when you won a seat on the school board. So what made you put your name forward, and what would you say to other Indigenous people who want to step into this kind of work?
My grandpa went to residential school in Saskatchewan. So did his brothers and sister. Many of my aunts and uncles went to residential school in Kamloops. My dad went to day school there. My granny was the first girl from our reserve in Kamloops to go to public school in town. So I'm sure you can imagine how challenging that was as well. And growing up on my reserve, essentially, I personally spend a lot of time in that residential school. I was actually just talking about this with someone the other day, and I was saying, you know, it's funny because my oldest daughter went to daycare in the residential school because we had offices and other spaces in there. So I was very connected to that place. And I remember growing up as a kid, and because we also had, you know, the band office and the tribal council and other Indigenous organizations where all our parents worked. And so I remember, you know, oftentimes, especially in the summer, but all throughout the year, we were always spending time around the complex, whether we were having basketball practice in the gym or we had a job there, part-time job, or we were just getting dropped off to go play while our parents went to work during summer holidays. And so we spent a lot of time in the residential school. And I remember even as a kid, the furniture was still in some of the rooms, you know, like if you went upstairs, like some of the bed frames were still shoved in the corner. Like if you could get in another room that was formerly a classroom, you might still find like some papers or some handbooks or like learning materials. Like it was all still there. And even though people in the community didn't really talk about their experiences at that time, and in our family, you know, even as little kids, we knew that that was, everyone just knew, you know, it was like there was a cafeteria in the basement and we would go and have lunch down there. Like, especially when our parents dropped us off, there was a lady from the reserve that was the chef in there, and she always fed us. And we knew that there was a like a dumbwaiter between floors. And I don't even ever remember anyone telling us this, but we knew that it was common knowledge that they used to put kids in the dumbwaiter and leave them in between floors to like punish them. I remember we would dare each other to run upstairs into the attic at the gym, like when we were having basketball practice, because we had been told that we thought it was really scary up there because we had been told that priests used to like put abortions in the walls of the attic. Like, and we're little kids and this is just like common knowledge. It wasn't ever like someone sat us down and told us these things. We just all kind of knew that these were really bad places where really bad things happened. And I had a number of summer jobs there as well, including working at the museum as a landscaper. And the museum is in the basement of the priest rectory, which is the small building on the side. You have the big building and there's a smaller red brick building on the side. And there's a heritage park, so where the graves were discovered. And we always knew, like it was not a something that we just learned, right? We always knew that that was what was there. We always knew that kids were buried on the school grounds. It was, again, common knowledge even to us as children. But I really remember all these things were just kind of known, right? It wasn't anything that anyone thought about or talked about or did anything about. And even when I worked there, all the time I spent there, bringing my daughter to daycare there, we used to run down the hall and dare each other to look into the boys' bathroom because everyone swore they saw a little boy crying by the urinal, you know, like things like that. It was just so normalized. And I remember when it was announced that the graves were actually officially, I guess, discovered. And one of the things that I really thought about was like, wow, you know, like I ate apples off the trees that are growing in those graves. Like, and that was just something that was so visceral for me and really struck me. And I started to think about as the truth about residential schools really started to come out and people started talking about it. I have my own children. I have three of them. And I started thinking, how do I have these conversations with my children? How do I tell them what happened to their grandpa and their cousins and their aunts and their uncles and their great grandparents who are all still alive? People they know and see, how do I tell them about these things? How do I educate them about the history of our people? And at the same time, still knowing that even in my own experience as a student, as a First Nations student coming from the reserve, we experienced so much racism and discrimination at school, and we were not often encouraged to do well or participate. And it's funny, even with my own children today, still they're always like, oh, did you play on the basketball team at school? Oh, did you do this at school? And I'm like, no, we didn't. I didn't do any of those things. We weren't encouraged to do those kinds of things. It was not like, I was never under the impression that that was for me, right? And so I think, again, you know, Kamloops is a very monochromatic town. It still is a lot today. It's obviously better, but it's still not great. And when I was growing up, yeah, it was really difficult. If you were coming to town from the reserve, like, people knew it and they treated you a certain way because of it. And so, yeah, school was really unpleasant. I didn't like it. I hated it, as a matter of fact. And I remember as I got older in the senior grades, when, again, it started to become cool to be Indigenous, being really resentful of people who had treated us really badly for many years. And all of a sudden, they were interested and they wanted to be our friends and they wanted to hang out with us. They wanted to come to the reserve. Whereas, you know, a few years earlier, they were accusing us of, like, being incest and drunks and, you know, all the stereotypes. I mean, people used to call us wagon burners and we're from Kamloops, you know, it's like all kinds of things. And I got in my first fight when I was in grade 3. And this little redhead girl was calling me a squaw. And I slapped her in the face, right? And ran away. So I don't know how much of a fight it was, but still, I still remember that, you know, and someone had told me that once, you know, who can remember the first time that they experienced, like, racism and discrimination? And it's just like these flood of experiences and memories. And many of them were at school. And I know that many children and youth still experience these things at school, not just Indigenous children and youth, but many children and youth who come from marginalized or oppressed communities, who are newcomers, maybe who have a different gender identity that other people don't understand. There's just so many different ways that children are different and not accepted for those differences and really struggle as a result of it. And those things bothered me because I related to them because of my experiences. My girls would come home and they, you know, some of them had a good experience at school and some of them didn't. Sometimes they would tell me about experiences that other kids were having, and it really bothered me. And so it kind of went back to what I was saying at the very beginning of this interview, is that I have always believed to make change, you have to make it from within. That's how I tried to make change. And so I decided, I guess, that I would run for school board and see what happened and try to bring that lens to build empathy to support all people who needed it, not just Indigenous peoples. So yeah, that's why I ran for school board. Which has become a much bigger and different thing than I ever imagined it would be.
I mean, just the context that you provided, so deep and so meaningful, like putting myself in a situation where I'm taking my child to the same school, the residential school, and looking at the past that you've been through, that your family's been through, that your community's been through. Is there a sense of reclamation in that process? Like, is there a sense of recovery? I mean, the atrocities, not recoverable, but is there a rebirthing? Is there something that you're able to reclaim in that process through what you're doing?
Some people think you can and some people think you can't. Like, if I go home, you know, and people will talk about different things they're doing to restore or renovate different aspects of the residential school, for example, some people want to do that because they feel that way. And other people are like, burn the place down, right? And many communities across Canada have done that. They've torn down residential schools and they've reclaimed the land. because the building is a structure that it's just the reminders of what it represents and what happened to people there, especially if many people are still alive. Like the last residential school in Canada closed in 1996. My cousin, who's the same age as me, went to it. Our grandpas, our brothers, like if I lived in Saskatchewan, I would have went to residential school. So it's a very real and recent memory for a lot of people. So I think for me personally, I don't want to claim that building either. To me, the building itself, it has really like bad medicine in it, really bad vibes. Like I don't think those things can go away. And it's not even just, you know, from a spiritual perspective. You think about one of my aunts died from lung cancer, and you know, there was a lot of talk about, did her experience at residential school and the asbestos that she was exposed to for so many years contribute to that? And it really made me think about all the years I ran around those hallways and played in those rooms that, you know, nobody used anymore, but were the same as they originally were. And that kind of scares me too, right? Like even from a very like real and visceral perspective. So no, to me, it doesn't feel like a good place. But when you live in community and resources are limited, you use what you have. And I think that's always been how Indigenous people exist. We adapt, I think, is probably a better way of saying that. Is that we've adapted to use this structure that has been left in our community instead of saying that we've reclaimed it, because it was never ours to begin with. That was never our place. That was never our way. So even though it still isn't our place and our way, we have adapted how we live in our community to use the structure in some ways.
Yeah, there's a really powerful quote, without community, there is no liberation. And the liberation is not going to look the same community to community, but it's dependent on being able to do that work together. And the thread that I'm hearing through so much of what you're talking about in that healing through reconciliation is building capacity generation over generation. And in the work that you're doing, being able to hold all of it in the same space, to have that space amongst the community for all of those things, all of those experiences, all of that learning. So for us as union workers trying to support and build capacity for Indigenous members here at the local and Indigenous listeners, how do we do better? What advice would you give us?
People always ask this question, right? And not just of me. I had a representative from a host nation tell me once that, you know, so many people are phoning them and sending them emails and knocking on their door saying, hey, we're ready to do reconciliation. Tell us what to do. We're ready. And her response to me was really basic, but so powerful. And it was just, do the work. Do the work before you come to us. Do the work before you come to have this conversation. Like, and a lot of what that means, I think, is about education. So I was actually at a blanket exercise last week with Sam George from Tsleil-Waututh, and Sam was talking about the truth before reconciliation. Is like the words come together, but we say truth first. And ultimately, you can't have reconciliation without the truth. So no matter how much work you do, no matter how well-intentioned you are to do reconciliation, if you don't really understand why you're doing reconciliation and for who, you can't really do reconciliation. So I think it's important. I know that people, again, are eager and they're really motivated and it's the time because everyone's talking about it. But it is really important to kind of slow down and do that work, educate yourself, really learn the truth and hear it from many different Indigenous voices. Because like I said, you know, we're not all the same and our experiences are not all the same. How we feel about what those experiences are or about our histories, even our shared experiences of colonization, they're not all the same, whether it's tear the school down, leave the school up, you know, any of these things, like whether it's we speak this language, well, we speak this language too, but we speak this dialect and the other people who speak this language speak, like, I mean, we're so different. So there's a lot to learn from Indigenous peoples. Like you can't just go to one place or one resource. And I think you really have to do the work to engage those authentic Indigenous voices too, because that is a very serious concern for Indigenous peoples is that, you know, given this trend of reconciliation, if you will, there are definitely people who are trying to take advantage of that. And there are people who are identifying as Indigenous and taking up space. And the harm that does is that people who have not lived as an Indigenous person, who have not experienced life as an Indigenous person, can't inform those processes because they don't know what they are. They don't know what it's like to live that experience. They can't see gaps that they've never experienced, right? And so that's why it causes a lot of harm when people take up that space. And that's why Indigenous people get so upset. You know, like people will say, oh, but Buffy St. Marie, she raised so much awareness for Indigenous peoples. And it's like, but like she doesn't know what she's talking about because she's not Indigenous. Like maybe if she had raised that awareness and created space for other Indigenous peoples, but she didn't. She took up that space and she spoke on our behalf without knowing what she should be saying, right? She just said what she thought she should say, what she thought people would believe, those kinds of things, right? And so even that was bias. Even that was through a lens. Even that was with, I would say, malicious intent, you know? And so I think that is a huge, huge responsibility that people also need to take on in their learning journey is really verifying who they're hearing from, whose voices they're amplifying, and who they're creating space for, because that's really important as well.
I'm just thinking about how you would go about doing that. We have our experiences in engaging membership in various ways. And how do you really do that?
You go to the source, right? So wherever you are, you're going to have host nations, right? You're going to have Indigenous organizations in your community that represent the urban or away Indigenous population, because you as a non-Indigenous person don't want to be verifying an Indigenous person's identity. Of course, there's definitely some issues and challenges around that. But one of the ways to get around that is to engage authentic Indigenous people who you do know or you do have relationships or connections with to help you do that work, right? Because Indigenous peoples decide who's a member of their community and who's not a member of their community. And so, for example, at City of Burnaby, one of the things that I try to encourage, for example, is maybe on a call for Indigenous public art, where I would say, okay, well, if you're going to be getting these proposals from Indigenous artists who are from host nations, and that's the priority, then we should talk to the host nations about having them appoint panelists to help choose the successful applicant, for example, right? Because they know who's in their community and who's not. They will make those decisions about who should represent them and who should speak on their behalf, right? And so it's really important to create that space to recognize those original stewards of the lands that you're on, whose territory you're on, and ask them, what do you think? If you're hiring, would you be on our board and creating that space too? Because I know, especially with unions, No offense, guys, but I know you have all kinds of rules about who can be on your interview panels, who can interview people for different kinds of jobs, but being flexible and in your efforts towards reconciliation to bring in those authentic Indigenous voices to help you make those decisions in a good way, right? And so say it is a panel for a hiring board, right? And you want to invite someone from a host nation to be on the board too, because you're hiring a director of Indigenous relations and you want to make sure that that person is authentic, right? They'll be able to say that even if that person is not from their community. It's funny because, you know, we can just be in the grocery store, walk down the street and see each other and know, right? Like you could just, I don't know. I can't explain it. It's funny, but people know. They know, especially if they're from community, they know someone who's not.
Thank you. Thank you for that, because these are challenging questions to even pose amongst ourselves. And so I appreciate that really open answer.
Yeah. You can also do things like add questions like to your calls for proposals or your job postings, for example, if you are trying to recruit Indigenous peoples or offering opportunities to Indigenous peoples, even at like markets, for example, those kind of things. You can always add, you know, a question that says, if you feel comfortable, could you share with us your connection to community? And that kind of puts it on them too to say, this is who I am, because that as Indigenous people, that's a cultural protocol of ours to say who we are and who we come from and where we come from, right? And so not to make it a required question, because I know there's, you know, legality and issues around that, but to offer it as an additional question. And 9 times out of 10, if an individual is an authentic person, they will be able and more than happy to provide that additional information. And then you can see for yourself when they say, oh, this is the community I'm from. This is where I lived. I'm a band member, you know, or I'm this or I'm that, right? So you'll be able to see. And if they can't, then you'll be able to see that too.
And I mean, definitely no offense taken, because the reality is for us to do the work, we have to hear criticism. But that's the important part of building capacity in us of being able to hear you're doing a bad job for these reasons, go do the work. Mm-hmm. And to take that without getting defensive, to be able to hear criticism, that's trust in community. Mm-hmm. And if we're accepting that we're in community doing this work, then we have to be ready to say, oh yeah, we need to know more and we need to do better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Share with us what you hope folks take away from attending the celebrations around Indigenous Peoples Day.
You know, today we've talked a lot about a lot of really heavy topics, I think, and absolutely the truth about colonization in this place that we now call Canada is pretty heavy. It's pretty dark. But I think what we as Indigenous people, and again, I don't want to speak for everybody, but June being National Indigenous Peoples History Month, I think the intention, I guess, behind National Indigenous Peoples Day is that, you know, there's also like really good things and really positive things. And we want people to see and learn those things too. We want people to be able to enjoy and celebrate our culture, our rich and vibrant cultures, plural, and languages, as well as, you know, understand and learn that really dark history and how that has impacted us through trauma. And I hate the word resilient. I think it's a really unfair word and I really dislike it because, you know, I don't understand why people can be strong only after experiencing extreme hardship. But it also demonstrates our resiliency as a people, that we're still beautiful and we're still thriving and growing and evolving. And we're still very much connected to those really important and beautiful parts of our culture and our identity as Indigenous peoples. And so I think that's really what I see June and National Indigenous Peoples Day being about, is about celebrating those really good things and kind of focusing on the beautiful parts of who we are as Indigenous peoples. But also, you know, I'm mindful that people shouldn't just be learning good or bad about Indigenous people in June or September. It's something that should be happening all year long.
Well, thank you. Michael, thank you so much for sharing space with us today and sharing your stories and your knowledge. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, and thank you too for creating the space. I really appreciate that and appreciate your willingness to be open and listen and ask questions because that's really important part of the process. So thank you too. Kukshachem.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in.
Apple Box Talks is an IATSE 891 production hosted by business representative Crystal Bronworth and assistant business representative Hilary Bergshoff and produced by Quentin Benetti. For more episodes, check out ourwork.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to follow us and leave us a 5-star review to go into the draw for an Apple Box Talks coffee mug. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Apple Box.